The Tolkien Road, Episode 242, Sauron Defeated, Part 1. Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 242. Greta, what's up?
Hey. What's up? Not much.
Cool.
What's up with you?
Much.
Yeah. All right. Well, good to know.
Indeed. All right. Boom.
Moving on.
Now that we've covered that absolutely nothing is going on in our lives. On this episode, we are continuing our journey through the History of Middle-earth series as we survey Volume 9, Sauron Defeated, which is the fourth and final volume focused on the textual history of the Lord of the Rings. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Lise Yu, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks indeed. Mm-hmm. Thank you to our executive producers and to all of our patrons.
Yes.
You too can become a patron of The Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Becoming a patron lets you support the show in a tangible way and lands you some awesome perks, like audio recordings of my two books, Tolkien's Requiem and Tolkien's Overture. So check it out now. patreon.com/Tolkien Road. All right. Also, yeah, iTunes and other whatever platform you listen on, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us over there. Help us out. Help get the word out. And by the way, we are currently sitting at 291 ratings on iTunes with a 4.5, 4.6 star average rating. So if you are a 5-star Tolkien Road fan and you haven't yet left your rated us on iTunes, help us get to 300 ratings by the next episode, right? So go over there. It's so easy, right? All you got to do is look at, you know, scroll down to like the bottom of your podcast feed when you're listening to us and just, you know, click 5 stars. And that'll help boost our average rating as well while you're at it. So, because I mean, let's be honest, this is a 5-star podcast.
For sure.
Right?
Yep.
So, or at least if you think it is, then go over and tell the world that you think it is. So, YouTube. So it's time for our weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all of those watching us on YouTube. So here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Whoosh.
Nice. I don't think your hand got in it,
by the way. I don't think my hand got in it either. Sorry. 3, 2, 1.
Whoosh. There we go. All right. So hopefully you were doing that right back at us.
Yes.
You too can be a part of the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5. Just head on over to YouTube where this episode is posted. And while you're at it, subscribe and click the notify bell for our channel. Or leave us a comment. You know, we love hearing from people over there. We love hearing from people regardless. But YouTube is a nice place because it's nice and easy to reply right over there too on a particular episode. And by the way, we just passed 600 subscribers on YouTube and we want to get to 1,000 as quickly as possible. Because at 1,000, we can start doing some really cool stuff and regular live streams will start to feel a little more feasible, right? So head on over and subscribe to the Tolkien Road YouTube channel so we can start doing even cooler stuff over on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
All right. Stick around to the end of the episode for correspondence. Greta?
Yeah.
Ready to explore Sauron Defeated?
You know what? I am.
All right.
I love anything with the word defeated in it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
It's going to be good.
All right.
Okay. Let's do it.
Especially Sauron being defeated.
Right?
I mean, come on. Who likes that guy?
Just the complete embodiment of evil.
Just ever since what he did to Gorlim, I'm just like, you're such a jerk.
Total jerk.
Jerk of jerks.
He deserves everything that's coming to him.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Sauron Defeated is the 9th volume in the History of Middle-earth series and the 4th volume in the subset collectively known as the History of the Lord of the Rings. It was published in 1992. The last volume, The War of the Ring, left off with an early version of the last chapter in Book 5, The Black Gate Opens. Sauron Defeated picks up essentially where Book 6 begins, with Tolkien plotting out the story of Frodo and Sam in Mordor. However, the direct textual history of The Lord of the Rings actually only takes up about a third of this book. The rest of the text is divided into two additional parts that focus on the late 40s work that Tolkien put into developing The Legend of Numenor. Here's what Christopher has to say overall about this volume. I'm the king of smooth transitions. All right. So this is Christopher. When The Lord of the Rings had still a long way to go, during the halt that lasted through 1945 and extended into 1946, The Return of the King being scarcely begun, my father had embarked on a work of a very different nature, the Notion Club papers. And from this had emerged a new language, Anduneic, and a new and remarkable version of the Numenorean legend, the drowning of Anadune, the development of which was closely entwined with that of the Notion Club papers. To retain the chronological order of writing, which it has been my aim to follow, so far as I could discover it, in the history of Middle-earth, I thought at one time to include in Volume 8, first, the history of the writing of the Two Towers, from the point reached in the Treason of Isengard, and then this new work of 1945 and 1946, reserving the history of the Return of the King to Volume 9. I was persuaded against this, I am sure rightly, and thus it is in the present book that the great disparity of subject matter appears, and the great difficulty of finding a title for it. My father's suggested title for Book 6 of The Lord of the Rings was The End of the Third Age, but it seemed very unsatisfactory to name this volume The End of the Third Age and Other Writings, when the other writings constituting two-thirds of the book were concerned with matters pertaining to the Second Age, and to whatever age we find ourselves in now. Sauron Defeated is my best attempt to find some sort of link between the disparate parts and so to name the whole. So
Christopher came up with the title.
Right.
Okay.
So in this case, it wasn't a it wasn't something that was that Tolkien had thought of using at one point himself, at least not that I remember, but I think this was Christopher's own idea as to what to call this volume. And it really what we see is that it has a dual meaning, right? Because yes, Sauron is defeated at the end of Lord of the Rings, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he's also defeated at the end of the Legend of Numenor, right? It's not a final defeat, but like it is in the end of the Lord of the Rings, but he is defeated in a very, for a very long period of time, he is defeated in the Legend of Numenor.
Right.
So that's where the title comes from, of Sauron Defeated.
Gotcha.
All right, so the table of contents consists of 26 chapters divided into three parts. Those parts are Part 1, The End of the Third Age, which goes from the Tower of Cirith Ungol to the Epilogue. Part 2, The Notion Club Papers. Part 3, The Drowning of Anadune. So those are the three parts. And then there's illustrations. There are 14, including further sketches of Orthanc and Dunharrow. But because of the thematic division in this volume, we will be tackling this volume in two parts. This episode will focus upon the portion directly relevant to The Lord of the Rings. And then on the next episode, we will take a closer look at the Notion Club papers and the drowning of Anadune.
Who is Anadune?
Anadune?
Yeah.
It's like the early name of Numenor, right?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's where like the language Anadunic or Andunic comes from, right?
Oh.
Or, Dúnedain, right? Related to that word, right?
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
All right. So let's look at some of the highlights from Part 1, which concerns The Lord of the Rings, the textual history of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So the first chapter of Part 1 is entitled The Story of Frodo and Sam in Mordor. It essentially traces the development of the Mount Doom climax from Tolkien's initial conception of it in 1939, when Frodo was still Bingo. There are some interesting directions Tolkien almost went with this portion of the story. For example, this passage. Perhaps better, and again, this is in Tolkien's kind of like thinking to himself voice, so don't get confused by that, all right? But, so he's kind of like thinking out loud, like thinking down on paper about what he wants to do with the story.
Not the actual story.
It's not him trying to write out the actual story, it's him thinking, like kind of taking notes, right?
Gotcha.
Perhaps better would be to make Gollum repent in a way. He is utterly wretched and commits suicide. Gollum has it, he cried. Gollum has it, he cried. No one else shall have it. I will destroy you all. He leaps into crack. Fire goes mad. Frodo is like to be destroyed. Nazgul shape at the door. Frodo is caught in the fire chamber and cannot get out. Here we all end together, said the Ringwraith. Frodo is too weary and lifeless to say nay. You first, said a voice, and Sam, with Sting, stabs the Black Rider from behind. Frodo and Sam escape and flee down mountainside, but they could not escape the running molten lava. They see eagles driving the Nazgul. Eagles rescue them. And he goes on to say, make issue of fire below them so that bridge is cut off and a sea of fire bars their retreat while mountain quivers and crumbles. Gandalf on White Eagle rescues them. Again, the sentence, he is utterly wretched and commits suicide, against the sentence, he is utterly wretched and commits suicide, referring to Gollum. The elder Tolkien subsequently wrote, no. So he's like, no, I'm not going to have Gollum commit suicide.
Yeah, that would be pretty.
At least not intentional suicide.
Right. So if he were to do that, I'm just wondering, is the ring still destroyed in this scenario?
Yeah, I think that was kind of the idea, is that he commits. It's Tolkien says a lot in a few short lines there. So at first he has this idea of Gollum repenting. And so is he saying that he kind of repents in a way by committing suicide with the ring?
With the ring. Okay.
And so it's kind of like this, not to get into like the morality of suicide, at all, but like, or in particular situations, but just to say, like, was he basically trying to say, like, this is kind of Gollum's only way to be heroic, like to actually do something, quasi virtuous at this point. Right. So,
interesting.
Really interesting. And I also liked just this idea that one of the Nazgul shows up, and then Sam, shows up and stabs it with Sting, right, and destroys the destroys the Nazgul that's trying to block Frodo's escape. So
right. So Sam remains a hero. Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's chapter. So that's kind of a highlight from chapter one. Chapter two is the Tower of Cirith Ungol, and it deals with Tolkien's working his way out of the corner he had painted himself into with Frodo's capture by the orcs. And so here's what Christopher has to say about this. It seems that my father returned to the story of Frodo and Sam more than 3 years after he had got the hero into such a fix, as he said in a letter of November 1944, that not even an author will be able to extricate him without labor and difficulty. As one of the outlines given in the preceding chapter shows, however, he had continued to give thought to the question, and while Book 5 was still in progress, he had discovered the essential element in Sam's rescue of Frodo, the quarrel of Shagrat and Gorbag and the Tower of Cirith Ungol, leading to the mutual slaughter of almost all the orcs, both of the Tower and of Minas Morgul, before Sam arrived. So, yeah, and it... I don't know. Just as I was reading that, it strikes me that it's interesting that two of the big, two of the defining moments in the journey of Frodo and Sam, where they have to, they're like stuck, in a really difficult situation, right? The way they get out of it is not really by their own skill or cleverness, but by the foolishness. I'll just use that term loosely. The foolishness of antagonists, right? So in this case, it's the orcs getting into fights with each other, right? And that allows Sam to kind of make his entrance into Cirith Ungol and rescue Frodo, right? Because otherwise, he's not gonna be able to go up against a whole garrison of orcs. And then with the case of Mount Doom and the destruction of the ring, it's Gollum's own like just joy and it getting the ring that ultimately allows it to be destroyed, right? That ultimately causes it to be destroyed. So,
That's an interesting observation.
Yeah. So,
what does that say about Sam and Frodo? I wonder.
I mean, I don't know that it necessarily changes the way we view Sam and Frodo. It's just something I'm trying to kind of call out as being an interesting narrative, an interesting way of Tolkien doing, constructing the narrative, right? That that these aren't. I guess what it says about Sam and Frodo is that they're not these, incredibly like strong, perfect heroes, right? But that they're reliant upon, other developments and kind of, I can't help but get like feel a little like, religious lesson in this and, all of our non-religious listeners may be rolling their eyes right now, but all I'm trying to say is that there's this idea of kind of like you're walking by faith, right? And all you don't exactly know like how this is going to all get resolved. You just know you have to walk this path and kind of trust that things are going to take care of themselves, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think Tolkien would have denied that insight, right? I don't think he would have said that's not at all what's going on. I think as a man of faith himself, he probably would have been like, yeah, I think that's right.
No, I agree. I totally agree. And I think you're right. I think it says about Sam and Frodo that not only were they that they were kind of in tune, right, with what was going on around mm-hmm. them, and they recognized, you know, those little gifts when they came, and they capitalized on them, right?
Yeah.
You know, it just makes me think of that little parable about how that guy who, you know, drowned, right? And he is in a lifeboat, and he's sinking, and, you know, he ends up drowning because he didn't recognize that someone comes by to save him in a boat, and he says, no, thank you, I'm, you know, God's going to save me. And then God sends a helicopter, and he's like, no, God's going to save me.
Right.
And then up in the heaven, he's like, why didn't you save me? He's like, I did. Like,
yeah.
I tried.
Well, yeah, and in that parable, it's like, you know, it doesn't say, like, God sent the helicopter and God sent the boat, but he's just right. Like, no, I'm not going to take this because I have faith. I'm going to wait for God to save me, right?
Exactly, but that's
the
fool.
And then he gets to heaven, and God's like, I sent the boat, I sent the
right,
helicopter.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I'm just saying there's, like, a way of walking by faith, but then there's a way of, like, almost being just clueless, right? Mm-hmm. And not willing to recognize when those opportunities arise, you know?
Well, and the whole idea of, like, walking by faith, I mean, it can in some sense be boiled down to walking by doing what you think is right, you know, mm-hmm. regardless of the consequences. Right.
Exactly.
And not knowing if you're going to make it, if you're going to complete the mission. And I think that's a big lesson so much of Lord of the Rings, something that stands out for so many of the characters in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Right. They don't know that they don't know they're going to be successful. So,
right. But just being able to recognize, you know, being able to recognize that, oh, this is, you know, this is how my faith is being played out right here.
Exactly.
You know, not be like, oh no, God would never, you know, or this can't be, you know, this can't be the way it's supposed to happen.
Right.
You know, cause like not being so married to your own preconceived notions, mm-hmm. right, about how something is supposed to play out, but being, you know, open-minded and willing to just kind of go with the flow and be like, okay, cool.
Yep.
We'll capitalize on the orcs fighting amongst themselves and, you know, Gollum's foolhardy joy. Anyway.
Right on.
I'll stop philosophizing.
Good insights. You'll stop philosophizing.
Philosophizing.
You can keep philosophizing. Ooh, I like falafel.
I like falafel too.
Music plays a massive role in Tolkien's legendarium. And on his new album, Eternal Flame, musical artist Blind Maysee has composed an album 100% derived from the stories of Middle-earth. Eternal Flame is a multi-genre original soundtrack inspired by the profound emotions of The Silmarillion, The Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit. Ranging from orchestra-themed songs to euphoric piano, Blind Maysee brings his own magical melodies to bear on Tolkien's myths. Check it out now! Just sit back, put your headphones on, and let the music of the Ainur flood your headspace. Eternal Flame by Blind Maysee is now out on all major streaming platforms. Visit blindmaysee.com today to embark on a new Tolkien-inspired musical adventure. Once again, that's blindmaysee.com. Chapter 3 is entitled The Land of Shadow, and it deals with the journey of Frodo and Sam from Cirith Ungol to Mount Doom. So what I'll say is I enjoyed this outtake of an interchange between Frodo and Sam. So again, an outtake. This was not included in the final version.
Didn't include the original one. I mean the
final version.
Final
yeah.
version. Okay.
So it goes like this. When he had finished, Frodo said nothing for some time, but took Sam's hand and pressed it. At length he stirred. So this is what comes of eavesdropping, Sam, he said. But I wonder if you'll ever get back. Perhaps it would have been safer to have been turned into a toad as Gandalf threatened. Do you remember that day, Sam, he said, and clipping the hedges under the window? I do, Mr. Frodo, and I bet things are in a nasty mess there now with that Lobelia and her Cosimo, begging your pardon. There'll be trouble if we ever get back. I shouldn't worry about that if I were you, said Frodo. We've got to go on again now, east, Sam, not west. I wonder how long it will be before we are caught and all this slinking and toiling will be over. So I just like that, like, you know, Frodo being like, hey, maybe it would have been better if Gandalf had just turned you into a toad, right? that made me chuckle.
I missed that. I didn't realize that's what he said.
Yeah, he said, right here, he said, I wonder if you'll ever get back. Perhaps it would have been safer to have been turned into a toad as Gandalf threatened.
Oh, I see. How could being a toad be safer?
It's not supposed to be. It's just he's saying, you know, they're in, obviously
they're
in the middle of Mordor right now, yeah. right? And yeah. he's like,
anything would be better.
Would you have rather been turned into a toad at this point?
Mm-hmm. I guess you'd be able to camouflage better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sneak into the gate unnoticed.
Oh, speaking of toads, I got to tell you guys this. This is kind of a cool little aside. I've been listening to Wind in the Willows on via Audible lately, and so I was doing some yard work the other day, and I was just listening to a story. I think it's the part where Mr. Toad is he like gets in trouble with him because he steals the car and he gets in trouble. Literally, as I'm listening to that, I'm trying to fix this hose kind of holder in our front yard, and this like little toad pops out of the and like we don't see toads all the time around here, like we're not like in a swamp or something like that, so it was like whoa, that's weird, like, you know, this toad must have known I was listening to a story about him or something like that. So
it's cool.
Yeah, just kind of a funny little moment. Yeah, funny little coinky dink.
Yep.
All right, chapter 4. Let's see. Yeah, chapter 4, Mount Doom, focuses on the development of the actual scene where the ring is destroyed. Of it, Christopher says, "It is possible that some more primitive material has disappeared, but it seems to me far more probable that the long thought which my father had given to the ascent of Mount Doom and the destruction of the ring enabled him, when at last he came to write it, to achieve it more quickly and surely than almost any earlier chapter in The Lord of the Rings. He had known from far back that when Frodo came to the crack of doom, he would be unable to cast away the ring, and that Gollum would take it and fall into the chasm. But how did he fall? In subsequent outlines, Sam's part was pondered. My father knew that Sam was attacked by Gollum on the way up the mountain and delayed, so that Frodo made the final ascent alone. And he knew that Gollum got hold of the ring by taking Frodo's finger with it. But for a long time, he thought that it was Sam who, finally making his way to the Chamber of Fire, pushed Gollum with the ring into the abyss. In none of the later outlines given in Chapter 1 did he achieve the final articulation of the story. But there seems good reason to think that these belong to the period of the writing of Book 5, and if my chronological deductions are correct, he had plenty of time to find out what really happened before he came actually to describe the final moments of the quest." So the real, I guess, point of significance for that, you know, the whole Mount Doom fiery room scene is what's Sam's role, right? That's Tolkien knew from an early point that Frodo wouldn't be able to destroy the ring himself, and that Gollum would kind of have to be the one that ultimately like perishes with the ring. But it wasn't clear exactly how Sam would play onto all that, and that would happen with Gollum, and then second of all, what role Sam would play in that. So so that's the thing that was the sticky point of this particular scene. Chapter 5 focuses on the Field of Cormallen. For this chapter, I was really interested in the development of Sam's astonishment at seeing Gandalf alive. You know, of course, that famous scene, one of my favorite scenes in the whole book, in all of literature, is, you know, is everything sad going to come untrue, right? Mm-hmm. That line from Sam just always makes me tear up a little bit. And it's interesting to note that Christopher says this: "Another difference in this manuscript, which survived long into the final typescript of the chapter, was the absence of Sam's expression of astonishment at seeing Gandalf at his bedside." So apparently that didn't find its way in until very late in the process, right? Sam's astonishment there. Interesting little note, but, you know, like, I mean, I think what we're finding is so much, you know, so much about what I think can make a work truly great are those, like, when you've got the draft done and you're able to just go back and really, like, be like, okay, now how do we make this really awesome, right?
Mm-hmm. Little touches.
I think there's a creative lesson to be made. I know that's true, again, in my own experience, like especially when I'm writing a song, like, it's, you know, you got kind of the sketch, finally you got like the lyrics sketched out, and you got kind of the structure sketched out, and just being able to go back and like tightly kind of hone, like fine tune, you know, all the different points of it until you get to something you're just like, yes, that is how it's supposed to be right there. That hits all the right notes, everything that I kind of sense that this should be, right?
Yeah, it makes sense too.
Yeah,
I mean, you think about building anything, right? I mean, you first get the foundation, and then you get the framework, and then it's all the final touches, you know, that make it special and unique. So it's, you know, it's something to be said for not being a perfectionist on the first time around, right? Just get down the high points, the stuff that you definitely have to have in there, and you can go back and fine tune.
Word.
Yeah.
Word.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's easier because you don't have, you know, you're, I mean, I'm not a writer in any sense of the word, but I do like to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's just, you know, it's kind of the same thing, right? Like, you know, you have your must-haves, right? Well, I want to include these ingredients, you know, and then you just kind of taste and season and whatever. That's kind of what Tolkien's doing here. He's seasoning it, right? Mm-hmm. With those little touches. And then it takes some of the pressure off because you already have the main dish mostly done,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
You just got to finish it off. Make it perfect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's really interesting to me though, that scene is kind of an add-on because it seems so crucial to me.
I know.
Like, it just seems so like without it, it would almost be a, like, it just would change the tone, I feel like, a lot.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that happens in that chapter. It's, you know, it's there's so many different, like, kind of ways in which loose ends are tied up, mm-hmm. and, you know, Tolkien was probably more focused on, like, how do I make the big scene of, you know, Frodo and Sam being, you know, kind of congratulated by all of, you know, all of the people of Gondor, you know, and celebrated by all the people of Gondor. You know, that was probably more in focus than just this quieter moment where Sam wakes up and realizes that Gandalf's alive when he thought he was dead,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, it's little touches that really elevate it, you know.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right, chapters 6 through 8 are very short chapters. We start to see with these that as Tolkien composed the denouement of his great epic, things began to flow fairly smoothly, and there aren't a lot of significant differences between the early drafts and the final version. However, chapter 9 focuses on the scouring of the Shire. There are a lot of differences here from the final text, and this is probably the longest chapter in part 1. But perhaps the most interesting is that the character Sharky exists, but is not Saruman, right? You remember Sharky from the Scouring of the Shire?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's this figure Sharky that they refer to, and then we realize late, you know, and once we're into the chapter, that Sharky is actually Saruman, right?
Right.
But Christopher gives a long version, like early version of the Scouring of the Shire, and Sharky is frequently referred to, but there's no indication, and he actually shows up, but there's no indication that it's Saruman, right? And so much so that it's clear that Tolkien wasn't like, this is going to be Saruman, right?
Mm.
He had to kind of discover over time that it was, you know, oh, maybe this is Saruman, right? In fact, it appears at first that he's simply like kind of the boss ruffian. You know, he's just another like guy, like man who shows up and is, you know, cracking heads, or maybe he's, you know, a hobbit, a bad hobbit, right? Saruman is mentioned as being behind all of the trouble, but not in a like on the scene kind of way. So that's an interesting note, mm-hmm. in terms of the development of this story. And you know, this, like I said, this is one of the most more interesting chapters in terms of its overall development, because it represents in itself something of a short story within the denouement of the greater story, right? That's the Scouring of the Shire is always an interesting thing to talk about because, you don't normally get, it's maybe more common. It's like, I feel like maybe more common in storytelling these days when you kind of think everything's done and then you have like one more big, attack by a bad guy or something like that. But that's maybe not even quite what this is, right? Because this is like not even the main bad guy that's coming back for another fight. But anyway, it's this, the chapter itself is like this short story within the denouement of the overall story, right? So there's just a lot more. It's not just like tying up loose ends. There's a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole story within itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what makes it one of the more interesting and long chapters in the book here. It probably took a little more development on Tolkien's part. And then chapter 10 is The Grey Havens. Perhaps the most interesting thing to note here is the matter of the title of the Red Book of Westmarch. This is really cool. So basically, Tolkien kind of sketches out different possible titles for the Red Book of Westmarch. So this is what Christopher says. The title page of the Red Book of Westmarch first appears in Manuscript B, with Bilbo's titles written one above the other and all struck through, which was the meaning of the word so and crossed out one after another. So here's what they are. Memoirs of an Amateur Burglar, My Unexpected Journey, There and Back Again and What Happened After, Adventures of Five Hobbits, The Case of the Great Ring, compiled from the records and notes of Bilbo Baggins and others, What the Bagginses Did in the War of the Ring, and then here Bilbo's hand ended and Frodo had written The Downfall of the Lord of the Rings and the Return of the King, as seen by Bilbo and Frodo Baggins, Sam Gamgee, Mary Brandybuck, Peregrine Took, supplemented by information provided by the wise. And then the typescript that followed B, the following was added, together with certain excerpts from books of lore translated by Bilbo Baggins and Rivendell. So I think I'm onto something about the whole frame narrative for the Silmarillion, you know, should involve all of them, right?
So those were alternate titles for the Red Book of Westmarch? Is that what you're saying?
Those were like Bilbo's titles that he was toying with, and then Frodo came up with the final title. I believe the final title actually appears in The Lord of the Rings, but I don't think it mentions any of the crossed out titles.
Okay, I was just gonna ask that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah.
I like the crossed out titles. I know. Though. They're all really good.
Well, they're fun to consider, you know, and there's something about those titles that makes, you know, because they make you realize like what people are thinking about this, you know, the focus of the story as they're writing it, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it tells you something about it, right? And it kind of gives you a perspective on it. So I just love that it starts out as like Memoirs of an Amateur Burglar, and it's like My Unexpected Journey, and There and Back Again, and What Happened After. Those three would just be like, it's just Bilbo, right? Because you know, those three just focus on the Hobbit, right? Mm-hmm. The story of the Hobbit.
Right.
And then Adventures of Five Hobbits would be like, okay, now we're talking about what happened with Bilbo and Frodo, Sam, Merry, and Pippin. And then it's like The Case of the Great Ring. Oh, you know, that's even more what the Bagginses did in the War of the Ring, right? So it's like Bilbo's like adding to this Red Book of Westmarch, mm-hmm, more and more as he's going and having to change the title.
The Case of the Great Ring makes me think of all those Nancy Drew novels that I read as a...
It sounds like a detective story.
It does, yes.
That would be fun. Like to think of Bilbo like in... you know, is like a
Hardy Boy
detective, man, you know, there's I really do hope that one day there is and I know some of you do not want this, but part of me just would like there to be more stories like of just Bilbo going on adventures, or you know, other like other characters doing, you know,
it's like
we
some
know.
Fan fiction kind of stuff.
Well, not just fan fiction, but like an expansion of the, you know, expansion of the universe that's like actually kind of like quote unquote official, done well, of course, right? Having to be true to Tolkien's vision, just like everything should.
Yeah.
That happens within Middle Earth, but I don't know. I just would really enjoy, like, you know, it's just like a well-written story of Bilbo going on another adventure or something like that, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe doing some detective work of his own.
I know. That would be really fun.
I don't know what it would be, but it would just be fun. I mean, you got all this time that elapses between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. Surely there's a lot of cool stuff he did during that time period.
Yeah. Yeah. So I agree.
Well, and I will say playing the Lord of the Rings online game gives you some of that, right? It's you know, it's not official, I guess, in terms of the lore, but it's very well done. I don't get much time to play it, but you know, I really enjoy playing that that game whenever I get a little time. And you know, you just, there's all these little things, all these little adventures you can go on, you know, all these little things, so it just feels immersive into that world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
cool.
Yeah. So, and then the last chapter of part one is the epilogue. And here's the thing. We actually did an entire episode on this chapter back on episode 142, because this is the epilogue to The Lord of the Rings that was left out of the final version, right? So we're not going to talk about that at all in this episode. You're just going to have to go back to episode 142, which we'll link to in the show notes, and you can listen to it over there if you haven't already listened to it. So yeah, that's our survey of Sauron Defeated part one.
Okay.
As always, this is just an overview with a few highlights, so make sure you get a copy of the book and dive in yourself.
Yes. Word.
Word.
Boom.
Boom, boom, boom. All right. Correspondence time.
Oh, fun, fun.
All right. First piece of correspondence comes from David Bates of Pints with Jack. And we asked him for a little help on pronouncing Pembroke last week, and it turns out I was correct, right? I think I probably said it more like Pembroke, but it's Pembroke, you know? So but he said Pembroke, correctly pronounced.
Awesome.
At least I didn't butcher it as much as Maudlin, right? So thanks,
well,
David.
Well done, you.
Thanks for letting me know and doing the research for me that I probably could have easily done myself by just going to YouTube, by just looking it up on YouTube, but... you know,
well, I don't know. I feel like
it feels a little more official to come from David.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It just carries more weight coming from David.
Because you can find, this is like Captain Obvious statement, but you can find bad information about how to pronounce certain things. I was actually looking up something the other day, and maybe it was the word cosmogony, because I always, like, even though I've used that term so many times, I always have to remind myself when it's been a long time, is it cosmogony or cosmogony? And I think I looked that up, and the first thing that came up was cosmogony. And I was like, I don't think that's right. And then I like kept looking, and I'm like, okay, no, it is cosmogony. Okay. So, you know, even Google with all of its crazy algorithms isn't always right. So
PSA.
Lesson learned. Mm-hmm. That's right. Public service announcement for
if
you.
If you read
week.
It on the internet, it doesn't automatically mean it's true.
Yes.
Just saying.
Yes. That's you learn important things from listening to our podcast.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Thanks, David.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Next up is an email from Marilyn the librarian on May 17th entitled Spiders and Such. She says, "Hello, Carswells. Persistence pays. Despite the difficulties of the history of Middle Earth, you're bringing up interesting nuggets for us to mull over."
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's
so
good.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yes, Lord of the Rings does make it clear that Shelob is Ungoliant's offspring. After Frodo has cut the webs and flees toward the pass, Tolkien writes a bit more about Shelob, including this. "But none could rival her, Shelob the Great, last child of Ungoliant to trouble the unhappy world." Mm. Let me interject right here and say, first, thanks, Marilyn. And then we also had a note on a YouTube comment from Tom M, who's one of our patrons, and he said yes, he confirmed it too. He was like, "I don't have the citation right in front of me, but yes, it's Shelob is referred to as Ungoliant's child in Lord of the Rings." So we had two confirmations. So, but let me continue with Marilyn's letter here. In letter number 70. He wrote to Christopher, "Do you think Shelob is a good name for a monstrous spider creature? It is, of course, only she plus lob equals spider, but written as one, it seems to be quite noisome. I can't recall where this fits in the chronology of what you shared with us today, but it seems that by that date he dropped the idea of naming Shelob Ungoliant, or thinking they were one and the same." Mm. Yeah, I'm not real sure where it falls into that whole chronology, but that seems about the right timing, because I feel like he was writing about that in like the 1943, 1944 sort of period. She goes on, "I found myself wondering if Tolkien knew that Denethor had been using the Palantir when he first wrote that scene you read, in which he was so much kinder to Faramir. If he didn't know, that might go some way to explaining why Denethor was so nice at first and later became so cold in his growing despair." Yeah, that's possible, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess what she's saying is that he would have had, the despair would have already been in him if he'd been using the Palantir already.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
So... she says, "I eagerly await Greta's rereading of the Akalabeth." Yes, we will. I do have that on our list here now. So I think we'll probably get to it shortly after we finish up History of Middle Earth.
Okay.
Yeah, so you've got a little bit of time.
I was going to say, you need to give me a deadline, because I work much better under the pressure of a deadline.
You work much better under pressure?
Well, under the pressure of a deadline.
I'm going to give you a deadline right now.
Okay. Maybe it's good that we're catching this on air. Because then there's record of it.
Hold you accountable. That's right. Okay. Let's see. Let's go with... yes. Let's say by end of June.
Oh.
End of June 2021.
Okay.
All right.
I got a month. a little more than a month.
That's okay. Right. And then sometime in July, we'll try and do that episode.
All right. Is that one that I'm going to be leading?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the plan.
All right.
I have taught you enough, young Padawan.
I'm afraid that remains to be seen. I'm definitely not. You don't want me doing the editing, though. That's for sure.
No, not doing the editing. Yeah.
But I'm going to do like show notes and like.
Yeah, just lead the discussion. I mean, I'll read it. I'll read it again, too. But just to lead the discussion. Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to remember how this all came about.
Well, so I think it was.
I know I mentioned it. Like, it was my idea.
Yeah.
But I can't remember what, like, put the idea in my head.
First of all, before I get away from Marilyn's note, Marilyn, thank you for your great note, as usual.
Yes.
I believe it was Paul that sent it. Let's see here. Looking back in my old notes.
Oh, so it was his suggestion?
I think it was.
Okay. We don't have to figure it out right now. I was just trying to remember, because I know we've talked about it quite a bit, and I just couldn't remember.
Like, yeah.
The, you know, how it all got started.
Well, I won't subject you guys to the pain of trying to figure it out right here on air. So, but anyway, it became a thing. Yeah.
All right. We're going to do it.
Do it. All right. All right. Well, that's all for correspondence this week. We'd love to hear from you. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com. Tolkien Road, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, etc.
Yeah.
I don't really know what the et cetera is at this point, but if you figure it out, let me know.
See.
If you send us a note and I can get and it gets to me, then I will then it will definitely go into our mailbag for potential reply on air.
All right.
On our next episode, we will cover part two of Sauron Defeated, which focuses on the Notion Club papers and the mid-40s development of the history of Numenor. So I am looking forward to that.
Yeah, it sounds good.
All right.
I love anything that has to do with Numenor.
Absolutely, me too. Mm-hmm. Look at you. Now you're all about Numenor all of a sudden.
Numenor. I like
gonna
Numenor.
Gonna become a Calibeth. This will be good for you, you know. When the show comes out, now you'll really know what you're talking about.
That's true.
And all the world is being like, Numenor's cool, and you'll be like, I already knew that.
I've been there, done that.
You'll just walk around with a shirt that says, ask me anything about Numenor.
Or, I love Numenor before it was cool.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay.
Numenorian nerd.
Oh.
Numenerd.
Copyright. John Carswell.
That's right.
What is today? May 21st, 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Done. Boom. Send me all of the money for all the proceeds. All right.
That might need to go on a t-shirt that we sell in our e-shop. Numenerd. Mm-hmm. Numenerd.
All right, y'all. That's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially the following. Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
The Sue.
Andrew T.
John R.
Ms. Anonymous.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Johanna T.
Mike M.
Duranayir.
Robert H.
Paul D.
Jacob S.
And Julia.
As well as all those celebrating their patron anniversary in May. Ms. Anonymous.
Joshua Y.
Donna S.
Rebecca R.
James R.
And Ty M.
Thank you all so much.
Yes, thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.